welcome to the Medical Journal of Australia podcast. The MJA is Australia's top peer-reviewed general medical journal, publishing groundbreaking research to the medical community since 1914. My name is Kate Swanell, and I am the MJA's news and online editor. People with celiac disease must stick to a lifelong gluten-free diet in order to optimise their gut's chances of recovery. Eating out, therefore, can be a real challenge. Many restaurants and food outlets offer gluten-free meals, but according to new research out of Melbourne, not all gluten-free meals are created equal. Dr. Jason Tiedin is laboratory head at the Walter and Eliza Hall Institute of Medical Research and is a consultant gastroenterologist at Royal Melbourne Hospital. He's chatting with me today about this new research. Why did you think to do it? Were you tipped off that some restaurants were not doing the right thing, or were not doing the healthy thing?
It's interesting in that anecdotally, patients with celiac disease often report getting sick after eating out at restaurants or takeaway joints. But no one's really ever sort of correlated that with whether that's actually due to inadvertent gluten exposure. That's been the presumption, but we all know that patients often get sick for a whole range of reasons when they eat out. So it was really the need to bring some objectivity to this kind of anecdotal observation. And the other driver really is the fact that many people with celiac disease, despite being strict with the gluten-free diet, don't achieve full healing of their small bowel. And recent Australian data actually showed that about 50% of Australians with celiac disease following a strict diet after 5 years, only 50% had got full healing, and the other 50% still had some evidence of disease persistence. So the implication there was that there may be sources of gluten coming into people's diets without them really realising, and that causing persistent disease activity.
Tell us a little bit about the design of the study, what you decided to do, and I know you had to have some cooperation from the City of Melbourne, so what were you up to?
Yeah, so the study was made possible because of the City of Melbourne and the fact that they have access to food businesses and regularly send environmental health officers, or EHOs, out there to assess food products and undertake surveys. So we really worked closely with them, and it made this kind of research possible. And what we actually did was assess about 127 food businesses within the sort of council area in the City of Melbourne that were offering gluten-free food options. And the environmental health officers would go in sort of incognito initially and ask for some gluten-free foods and sample them and bag them up for testing, independent testing for gluten content. And then they would declare who they were and then would administer a survey to the manager to understand knowledge about gluten-free and gluten-free practices.
Right. Tell us what the major results were first.
Yeah, so of the 127 food businesses, about 158 food samples were collected, and testing showed that 14 of those, about 9%, had detectable gluten. Now, the current Food Standards Australia New Zealand ruling is that anything that's labelled gluten-free in Australia and New Zealand has to have no detectable gluten. So 9% of these products were sort of, I suppose, non-compliant with that particular code. And more concerningly, of that 14, 9 of those 14 were quite high in that they were over the 20 parts per million threshold, which is used in the United Kingdom and the US as a marker of what's gluten-free. So denotes a sort of higher level. And two of the products were actually over 80 parts per million, which is quite a substantial amount of gluten there. I think that there's, you know, overall these values show that gluten is coming into the diet, even when people ask for gluten-free foods. But, you know, it was interesting because the City of Melbourne had actually conducted some surveys previously in that area and studies, and in 2014 they showed 1 in 5 food samples had detectable gluten.
Okay.
2015, 15% of food samples had detectable gluten. So it has improved over time, and I think that's partly due to perhaps greater scrutiny of the businesses, because about a third of the businesses were tested on successive years. But it shows that, you know, scrutiny does seem to improve and reduce the rate of non-compliance, but it certainly is still present.
Yeah.
But what was really interesting is that the survey really highlighted a lack of understanding of what gluten-free really means and what are the standards. It showed, for instance, that a lot of businesses didn't really know that spelt wheat actually contains gluten. And when we looked at, we did a multivariate analysis of the different factors that link towards the presence of contamination, it was shown that a lack of staff training was a substantial factor. So there was, it was a 75%, the odds of that occurring was 75% more likely because if there was a lack of staff training. But conversely, there was a substantial reduction if the business was part of a franchise. So I think that the implication of the data really is that, you know, awareness that often comes with franchisees where there's a standard of practice that's sort of consistent among practices, that seems to have a positive benefit. But when there's a lack of staff training, then clearly that is a major factor in this whole issue of contamination. So I think it allows us now to really focus in on staff training as a major addressable issue that could overcome some of these problems.
Is there enough regulation of these rules? What more could be done?
Yeah, look, I think that's a good question. I think it's very variable. I mean, I think that many, if you go by patients, and I'm sure all of the listeners who have patients with celiac disease will have heard from their patients, you know, time and time again, oh, look, I went out, I got glutened, or, you know, I asked for this, and then they brought me, I asked for a gluten-free, and they brought me, the first thing they brought me was some bread rolls for the table or something like that. So, you know, it's very variable. And I think that to some extent we're underestimating the size of the problem because we look to the city of Melbourne, you know, where there's high demand for gluten-free, and I think general awareness is pretty good. But as you move out from urban areas to the country, for instance, not only is knowledge less favourable, but, you know, access to gluten-free is less favourable. So I think it's very variable in terms of practices. Mm-hmm. And I think if this data has taught us anything is to say that I think there needs to be greater awareness and actual efforts to try to introduce some degree of consistency and standards in how hospitality is trained.
I'm talking today with Jason Tiedin, who is a gastroenterologist and an expert in celiac disease. His co-authored research is published by the MJA and can be found at mja.com.au, where it is open access. How do you access that? Look, is that something that you need to get into the tech colleges, perhaps, the hospitality colleges? And
exactly. And I think that so a lot of this research has really highlighted the fact that we have to work closely with food industry.
Yeah.
And I know Celiac Australia had developed a few things, such as a hospitality training program that aims to sort of teach the FSAN standard and the best practice to in order to provide safe gluten-free foods. And also they have an accreditation program which is now being rolled out, and I think this is a way of ensuring businesses that adhere to the right standards to a very scrupulous sort of manner. And so I think these initiatives are examples of ways that hospitality can get more involved in providing safer options for patients. And you know, at the end of the day, for the doctors, it's all about making sure the patients are doing well on a gluten-free diet. There's nothing more frustrating than seeing the patient who continues to complain of symptoms or has specific disease activity despite seemingly doing the right thing. And I think these initiatives are quite important. And, you know, for businesses, it's also very interesting to see that, you know, offering gluten-free is a really advantageous sense that if you can do it properly, it really does bring a lot more people who want to eat at the business. But it's important that it's managed appropriately, because one of the things that can happen is when you speak to businesses, and if there's any sort of sense that there's punitive action, then they won't want to offer gluten-free, or that they're going to put disclaimers on their food, you know, may contain traces of gluten. And then that makes it difficult for patients to really know if they can eat there. So we want to work together with the food industry so that the outcomes are positive all around, really.
Does it prompt any further research, do you think?
I think this tells us that there's been very little scrutiny on the gluten-free diet as a treatment. We know it doesn't always work perfectly. We know there's huge heterogeneity in patient responses to gluten. We know that low levels, for example, some patients with celiac disease as little as 10 to 50 milligrams, so, you know, less than 1/100th of a slice of bread can cause that villus atrophy, whereas other people, larger amounts are probably needed to cause the changes. So there's variation. And why some people aren't healing isn't still fully explained. So we've shown that with this research, this is definitely a factor. If people are eating out regularly, if people are eating out at places that they're not familiar with. It's possible that, you know, that could be leading to gluten exposure that's causing their persistent disease activity. So I think that's a sort of, I suppose, a clinical lesson for doctors. If they have patients not resolving their symptoms or gut damage, perhaps they need to look at their eating and dining out habits. But yeah, there's other sources of gluten contamination. So I think future research really needs to look at whether manufactured gluten-free products can have gluten. There's very limited data on that in Australia as to how well gluten-free food providers making manufactured gluten-free foods are providing that. We're actually doing that study at the moment, getting data on that.
Yeah.
And I think that ultimately it's also understanding the patient factors. And we've recently completed some research showing that patient knowledge and psychological factors are two major things that impact on a person's ability to adhere to a gluten-free diet. And so traditionally, clinicians would send patients to dietitians for education on a gluten-free diet, and that was kind of about all we would do. But I think the data is really telling us now that it's much more than just simply telling people what they need to do. It's also telling them and managing the psychological aspects. And I think that for, you know, for all the doctors who manage obesity and all these other issues that require a psychological mindset to adhere to certain diets, then we appreciate that can be a very challenging thing, and the lifelong strict gluten-free diet really is a complex and challenging diet. So I think future research is really identifying better ways that we can educate patients so they can maintain the diet long-term appropriately.
If a gluten-free meal is being prepared in a kitchen that prepares gluten meals, meals with gluten in, is there a possibility of cross-contamination?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so cross-contamination is a major challenge. And in fact, that's that we, in the questionnaire, was asking questions about cross-contamination and how to minimise it. Responses weren't particularly great. So it, as part of this standardisation, it's all about identifying what contains gluten and how do you minimise cross-contamination. And it might seem very trivial to many people that, oh, look, you know, maybe a few crumbs here and there won't hurt. But, you know, over time, this can build up. It's fascinating to see that even small levels can trigger massive symptoms, in the sense that, you know, in the US recently, there was a batch of gluten-free Cheerios that had some wheat contamination. You know, only a small amount, but all these people around the country started to report being sick after eating their previously well-tolerated Cheerios. And that was how the whole issue came to light. So, you know, that small amounts can cause an issue. I suppose one of the other points I generally make is sort of a throwaway comment, is that it's important to view celiac disease as an illness and not, you know, a food fad. And for hospitality, there's this challenge about, you know, well, do we, you know, we often see people say, I need gluten-free, and then they see them sneaking a bit of bread roll from their, you know, the person they're dining with. And it's not only demoralising for hospitality because they're trying their best, but it kind of, I suppose, invalidates the legitimacy of the gluten-free diet as a medical treatment. But, I mean, so I always try to highlight the fact that, you know, patients are having issues like osteoporosis or infertility and occasionally lymphomas and autoimmune thyroid disease as part of their celiac disease. So, you know, so we're not kind of trying to make a big fuss about nothing, really. I think clear medical reason to be doing this. All right.
Thanks, Jason,
so much
for your time.
I appreciate that.
My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.